Good morning. Everybody's awake, just as that groundhog too, right? Puxatawny. Well, I do have news for you that Pastor Chris walked outside her door and she did see the sun this morning. So there was a shadow and therefore, what do they call that? Six more weeks of winter, right? I don't know if you're thankful for that or not, but regardless, we're glad that you're here today. And I'm Chris. I'm the pastor here at Table Life Church. If this is your first time with us, first time in a long time, whatever that may be, somewhere in between, we are just grateful that you're here. This is a good looking group here today. Let me just say that. I don't know about you guys online. I can't see you, but the folks here, you're looking good today. Looking pretty sharp there. Anyway, today we're going to start off a new series together. And I want to start off with a question for you that maybe you have wondered before, has crossed your mind in some way, shape, or form before. And that question is, have you ever wondered, why do bad things still happen even though I do the right thing? You ever wondered that? Why do bad things still happen even though I do the right thing? You know, there's an old saying that goes, no good deed goes unpunished. Maybe you've recited that before. But maybe you have decided to follow Jesus, that Jesus is a part of, is in your life, and you've decided to commit to doing his ways and his work, and you've still been hit by misfortune. The things have not been all butterflies and rainbows. And just to kind of stretch your mind a little bit, some things that might look like. Maybe at some point you have called out someone for doing something against the law, and then you were ostracized or attacked or even maybe dismissed from your job for doing so, right? Maybe you've had a cancer diagnosis and you've lived pretty healthy your whole life. You didn't smoke or drink, or you cut that back a long time ago, and you still have that diagnosis. Maybe you've worked long and hard and really cared about the job that you've been in, and you still lost it when the job cuts came, or you didn't get that promotion. Maybe you've worked long and hard to have a home, to have a place to call your own, and then something happened that was either destroyed or sold. Maybe for you is finally to have a child, to have children. And for some reason, whether through estrangement or tragedy, that those children are no longer in relationship with you. You know, why? I bet you've asked that question at some point for something. And whether it's been a big thing or something small, like why? Why do bad things still happen, even though I'm trying to do the right thing? Well, today we're going to begin a sermon series that presents that question, among other questions, that people have asked a long time, have asked for centuries of time. And the thing is, those of us that follow Christ, Christians, are usually inclined to look for some kind of divine reason behind catastrophes, behind personal tragedies. But through this series, we're going to be studying the Old Testament book of Job. And it's a really interesting story because I'm going to give you kind of a summary of it, right? That it's a story of a man who did everything right but had so many things go terribly wrong. That's the whole sum of the story. Like, a man who did everything right, but he had so many things, so many bad things happen to him. But even deeper than that, the point of the book of Job is to teach us about the mystery of evil, the mystery of suffering, and how the mystery of evil is really a mystery of a war-torn and complex creation, but it's not the mystery of God's all-controlling will. And sometimes we confuse those things. The actions and mystery of God, of evil in our world, and the complexity of creation and the messed upness of creation, as opposed to the mystery of God's all-controlling will, God being behind all the things that happen. So as we get started, I do want to point out a few things for this series. And you do have a worship guide that you've been given if you are in the room here. They're also online for our online friends, too. You can go to our webpage under resources. They're there, posted every week if you're a note-taking type. But just a couple things as we kind of start off this series. So just get on the same page here. So first, we're going to be studying an entire book of the Bible. We're going to do over 5 weeks. There is no way that we can point out every single verse, every single paragraph, every single chapter. But we are, I do want to encourage you, though, to read the entire book of Job. It's in the Old Testament scriptures. You have a hard time finding that in your Bible. You can go to the index. It's also, if you have the Bible app, it's very easy to find right on there. But I want to encourage you to read the entire book. We're in Sunday mornings, we're not going to be able to go through every single chapter and thing. But I want you to read the entire book because it's a really, really interesting story. And it's actually believed to be one of the first books of the Bible that was written down, the earliest book. You might say, well, what about Genesis? Well, it's actually believed that Job was the earliest to be written. It's the oldest book. But then also there's a question of who is Job? Was Job actually a person? Is this a literal account, word-for-word account, of something that happened to this man named Job? Or is it kind of a wisdom parable, or is it somewhere in between the two, that there was a man named Job, but the thing, and some bad things had happened to him, but the authors have kind of put in these conversations and languages because they're all written in lyric poetry. And I don't know about you, I don't go around talking in lyric poetry, maybe if you're Shakespeare in some way. But it's also a unique position in the Bible. That in the books, the breakdown of the books of the Bible, in the Old Testament scriptures, it's part of the wisdom literature of the Bible, like Proverbs and Song of Songs and those things, in the wisdom literature. So it's meant to teach us something. And scholars debate, you know, was Job all the way from one end to say, Job, this is just a whole allegory and parable, he never existed, to the point of, no, it's an actual literal person in every single word. And it tends to be somewhere maybe in between those things. But the point is, it's meant to teach us about God and the story of this man. But also, another thing we have to think about is that when you're reading the book of Job, and when we're talking about here, you have to be careful what you quote. Got to be careful. I would say for the whole Bible, really, you got to be careful for what you quote. That just because something, a verse or a quote is in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily mean that the people that are saying it are expressing truth about God. It doesn't necessarily mean that that quote represents exactly what's true about God. Because guess what? The whole book of Job is really God refuting all the things that people are saying, including Job himself. So pay attention to that. But finally, Job is not going to offer easy answers. He's not going to offer easy answers to us. And I'm not going to attempt to give easy answers either, like pose some questions and throw out some things here. That wrestling with Job is going to bring some new questions and maybe some fresh insights about the work of God, the character of God, and why do bad things still happen even when I do the right thing. So all that being said, today I want to kind of set the stage here. So I'm going to set up what this book is really about. And we're going to discover in a little bit that the majority of the book of Job is conversations between Job and his friends. Job eventually and God. But all these conversations that take place. But before that, we have to set the stage to understand what it is that's happened in Job's life. And so we're going to jump in the very beginning in what's called the prologue. That's how this is broken down, the prologue of the book of Job in chapters 1 to 2. And this is the earthly scene. This is what's taking place on earth, what happened to Job. So let's start off with just the very first verse here. It tells us a lot. So Job chapter 1, verse 1. A man in the land of Uz was named Job. That man was honest, a person of absolute integrity. He feared God and avoided evil. So let's just pause here. So first, this shares where he is from and his name. Like both that are super important. So where is he from? Uz. You know where Uz is? Anybody? Nobody knows where Uz is, actually. Scholars have debated over years and years where Uz is. It's not in Israel. It's not an Israelite name. It must mean a place that's far away. But then we have the name Job, which is also really, really unusual because once again, Job is not a name that was used at all in Israel. It's not an Israelite name. So off the bat, the story is kind of weird. It's kind of unusual that the people hearing this or reading this have been like, okay, this man in a city I don't really know, and he has this very strange foreign name here. But then the important facts that the story hinges on are this, that he was honest, he had absolute integrity, right? He feared God. He'd avoided evil. He was a good, good man. He's a good Job, right? He's just a good guy overall. That's like the main factor here. And then if we continue, in verses 2 to 3, it says this. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters and owned 7,000 sheep. That's a lot of sheep, right? 3,000 camels. Do they spit? I don't know. 500 pairs of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a vast number of servants. So he was greater than all the people of the East. So just a little note about numbers here. Numbers in the Bible, especially the numbers 7, 3, and 10, have significance. That they mean completeness. So in a sense, did he have 502 donkeys? Maybe, like it's possible. Did he have 3,000 camels or 4,000? But there's a sense of completeness, a sense to say that Job's life was complete. It was whole. He had everything. He had everything a man of his time could have wanted or needed. We also have to understand, in other words, that no one was more exemplary than Job. He was perfect. He's a good man, but also his life is perfect. He has everything. We say like all the blessings, right? Everything. But then suddenly the story shifts scenes here from down on earth to up in heaven. There's a scene shift. So I want you to picture this. So this is what's going on. This man, you imagine the narrator's talking about. He has all this stuff and he's down. And then all of a sudden the camera pans up to the heavens. And we hear this, starting in verse 6. One day, the divine beings came to present themselves before the Lord. And the adversary also came among them. The Lord said to the adversary, "Where did you come from?" The adversary answered the Lord, "From wandering throughout the earth." The Lord said to the adversary, "Have you thought about my servant Job? Surely there is no one like him on earth, a man who's honest, who's of absolute integrity, who reveres God and avoids evil." So let's just pause there. This is the heavenly scene. All of a sudden, we shift scenes to heaven, and basically the picture is God holding a heavenly meeting. He has meetings. I don't like meetings, but God has meetings. He has meetings. And he's having a meeting with who? The divine beings, right? Like the angels, some translations say. The divine beings that he has created, imagine they're all like, they sit around like a big table or something. They're all drinking coffee together. Everybody has their laptops out. They're all working really hard. But then, who do we see that shows up uninvited? The adversary. The adversary. The one who is called adversary shows up. He is not invited to the meeting. He shows up. And he's the one that butts in, breaks into the meeting. I don't know if you've ever had that happen before. Like somebody walks in, barges in the middle of the meeting. You're like, oh, now what, right? Okay. Well, he barges in to have a conversation with God. So just pause there for a second. Some of you may have a translation of your Bible, and it will say Satan in it. I just want to give you a picture. The Hebrew word that's used there in the original language is Hasatan. Can you say that? Hasatan. That's the word from which we get Satan. But guess what? It's not a name. It's a thing. It's a title. It means adversary or accuser. It's not a proper name. It's like talking about the Facebook, right? Like the Facebook, the Satan, the thing that's walking around. It's not a name given to this guy. He's a thing. He's a thing. He's the adversary. So God seems really surprised to see him, especially barging into the meeting. And so what does God ask? Like, where'd you come from? Because he knows. The adversary's response is, well, I've been kind of here and there. I've been chilling, right? Wandering throughout the earth. He's not like the other angels who are carrying out assignments from God, who are following God's directions and respecting and under God's authority. Instead, this adversary is just doing what he wants. He's just doing what he wants. And so God kind of breaks the conversation and says, well, when you were doing your wandering thing, right? Like, did you see Job? For example, I bet you saw a lot of people, but did you see Job? He's the man. He's just awesome. I am very proud of this guy. But then what does the adversary say? Probably in like a language like, I don't know. I'm not so sure. I saw him, but I have questions about this Job guy. So we see in verse 9, the adversary answered the Lord, does Job revere God for nothing? Haven't you fenced him in, his house, all he has, and blessed the work of his hands so that his possessions extend throughout the earth? But stretch out your hand and strike all he has. He will certainly curse you to your face, God, right? So what does he say? He's saying basically, hey, God, this person, and he's making a generalization here, that the people, human beings, only really serve you and follow you because it's what they get out of it. They are out in it for the blessings, God. Would he still love you if everything went bad? Like, he's blessed. It's easy to love somebody that gives you gifts, right? It's easy to love somebody that is nice to you and loves you and does all good things. But the adversary is very clever here. The guy who doesn't follow God's directions, who does his own thing, is wandering about the earth. He causes a little trouble. He asks, does Job love you for you, God? Or does Job love you only for what he gets from you? So let's continue. What is God's response? So it says, the Lord said to the adversary, look, all he has is within your power. Only don't stretch out your hand against him. So the adversary left the Lord's presence. So what happens there? Well, God allows the Hasatan to go and to test Job. See, it's a question, well, why did God do that? Well, had God simply silenced the Satan without proving him wrong, it would have simply confirmed the accuracy of Satan's charge. The challenge had to be put to a test. And so God's not the actor here, but he simply removes the protective force he has around Job and allows Hasatan to do as he wants. So what happens next, though? It's kind of extreme here. So suddenly, we have this guy who had everything, right? He's like the perfect example. He has everything he wants, and suddenly, like, everything goes wrong. So with his kids, with his animals, with his home, his house collapses. It's just like the worst day that you can imagine. And already, I'm sure many of you can identify with this. It's just like one thing goes wrong, and then what? Everything goes wrong, right? It's just like one thing after another. But then the chapter ends with a simple statement. In verse 22, it says this, in all this, Job didn't sin or blame God. Job didn't sin or blame God. All this had happened, and he didn't sin, and he didn't blame God for it. And you know what happened because of that? The adversary, Hasatan, he's got even madder. He's like, what's with this? He should have gotten mad and cursed God. Like, Job's messing the story up. He says, what? So what happens? Chapter 2 happens. And chapter 2 repeats chapter 1. And you see that there's patterns here. And in the Hebrew, it's hard to translate into English. But in the Hebrew, it's all lyric. It's all these same patterns of imagine, like lyric poetry. That's example. And the adversary goes back and does more. And what he does to Job? He destroys his health. He destroys his well-being. And guess what? Job's wife, she tells him, you should curse God for this. So everybody's against him. And yet Job refuses. It refuses. And the chapter ends with this very interesting rhetorical question where Job says this. He says, will we receive good from God, but not also receive bad? And in all this, Job didn't sin with his lips. Now, before you quote Job there, and before you make a theological statement about God being the one that gives bad things, we have to remember that while Job, his heart is pure, he's in the dark about all the heavenly plane, about everything that had happened. He's in the dark about everything that was taking place. And not only that, he's wrong. He's wrong. We just saw it. God wasn't doing it. The adversary is the one that's causing all this. See, the whole story of Job is about God teaching and correcting human beings to say, no, 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 what you think is taking place is not actually taking place. Let me clear that up for you. Job is being corrected here. See, the beginning of the story of Job poses to us a really good question, though. Why do you love God? Why do you love God? Or even put it more sharply, do you love God for only what you get? Do you love God? Is it like a vending machine God, right? Like you just put in the money, press the buttons, and then boom, and then sometimes you got to kick it a couple times, right? Get the thing out. But is only God, your relationship with God, about what you can get from God? And then, you know, likewise, when it doesn't or something bad, like you get angry about that, you know, what would you do if suddenly everything went wrong? Would you still love God? Would you still do right? John Gottman is a marriage therapist, and he's done a lot of studies on married couples and has podcasts and all kinds of workshops and things that you can listen to. And in one of his studies as a therapist, he had couples come in and live in an apartment so he could study them. It's kind of like the version of like Big Brother marriage style. I'm not sure if I would approve of that. But anyway, he invited these people, and willingly, they would come in and be studied by living in this apartment. He would watch their interactions, but especially what he would watch was the way that they fought. He watched their fights. And what was interesting was that time and time again, as he watched couple after couple, he found that as time went by, that one of the predictors of a healthy marriage and longevity of marriage was this, that when the couple begins to fight, he noticed, do they turn towards each other or do they turn away from each other? Do they turn towards each other or away? That he noticed, and he watched these, once again, following these couples throughout time, that healthy marriages and long marriages don't turn away, but turn towards. It's an interesting thing. I've thought about that. After reading the studies that he did about how people turning towards, even during the midst of a conflict, is the best predictor of the longevity and the health of the relationship. And I think it's true about our marriages, our relationships, our friendships, even in churches, right? But I think it's also true about life, that especially in times of difficulty and struggle and conflict and hardship and those disappointments that just rock your world, how we respond to it says a lot. It says a lot. Do we use those things in the midst of them as opportunities to turn towards or away? Do we turn towards one another or do we turn away and cut off or a ghost or do our own thing and refuse? Well, what do we do? Is our response to turn towards God or away from God when the hardship hits? It's just like several years ago, I had a event in the church I was serving before I came here that took place in two different families. And it was very, very similar, kind of very big life event that took place. And it was very interesting that as me and other pastors on our pastoral team were taking care of these people and checking in and seeing their needs, it was very interesting to see the different siblings and how they acted in the midst of that. And it did involve a loss. And it was very interesting that the same event took place in these two families, and there were two very different reactions, two different directions. One, the siblings lost their faith in God. They turned away from church. They said, well, I don't believe anymore. If that happened and you have a loving God, then I'm just going to go away and I don't believe in any of that. But it was interesting that the other family, though, was a totally different story. Very similar loss. And instead, they drew closer. They became more connected. They allowed the community to surround them and to love them. And they grew from that in their faith. They dove in and asked the hard questions. Why? And I'm going to look this up. And I'm going to read the Bible. And I'm going to read scripture. Not only that, but I'm going to read some research about this. And I'm going to look at what some other people have said. And it was interesting to watch this one family, I'm not even sure what happened to, this other family moved closer and deeper. And it was evident that something happened in them, even in the midst of some hard time and tragedy, that turning towards was so much more fruitful. And I don't know if they had all their questions answered, but I knew that they grew. And the thing is, I share that with no judgment, because the truth is, I've done both. I've done both in my own life, and I bet that you have too. Going towards or away, there's going to be things that happen, though, that we don't want in life. There's going to be things that happen out of the blue, loss and disappointment. There's tragedies. I mean, even this past week, we had several tragedies with airplanes. Like, those people had no idea. Their families had no idea of what was going to take place. Those things just, they hit us. There's going to be times that you've done the right thing. You've made the right choice. You know, you went to the meeting. You quit that the thing that you thought that you were needing. You've surrounded yourself with the right people. You made the right choices and the right path, and you've lived with integrity. But then the bad thing happened anyway. And when all that happens, it's just like Job. It's going to be a test to our faith. It's going to be a test to our faith. And that's when, friends, the adversary comes in and says, here, if I just hit him hard enough, then you're just going to fall away. The adversary assumes the awayness, but not the turning towards. See, friends, we can't choose if and when bad things happen, but what we can choose is our response. Do we give up and turn away, or do we turn towards? Do we use those things to turn away, or do we turn towards and grow deeper and harder and dive into those hard spaces? And I think much of it depends on our understanding of God. That for many of us, you know, growing up in church or not, you know, God often we think of as this cosmic school principal. You know, and this is not a downer any of our principals in the room, but cosmic school principal, God, that the good, when you did good, you get what? The Jolly Ranchers, at least we did in elementary school. You get rewards when you do good. You get what? Extra recess. Like, yay, I get all the good things. But then when you were late, you pulled her hair, you did something, you got punishment, right? School principal, got to go to the office now. You got to sit in the office for the rest of the day. Got to call home, tell about the horrible things that you did. And we think of God like that often. That the way the world works too, that it makes sense that it seems that God would work the way that the world works as well. But here's the problem with that. God doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. At some point, something will happen that you and I don't deserve. Whether that's a job loss or relationships or left by friends or a diagnosis or something unravels or a natural disaster or a tragedy. But the truth is, bad things don't just happen to bad people. They happen to all people. Bad things don't just happen to bad people. They happen to all people. Our broken world, the corruption of our world, that there's things that happen that are not part of God's plan or purpose. And if we carry around an image of God like that as this punishing cosmic school principal that we do bad, oh my gosh, he's gonna, you know, at some point we lose our faith and we turn away. See, in a way, Job opens us up to a totally different way of seeing God. The way that God is talked about consistently in the Bible, the God that Jesus demonstrated and lived out and talked about. A hopeful view of God. For in John chapter 3 says this, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Even when bad things happen, God is active and loving and present. Yes, the adversary has his way sometimes. But we see the story of Jesus, though, even to the cross, is a story of God allowing evil to have its way for a period of time, but only for a time. The hope is what God has up his sleeve, that God is at work in a different way, doing things differently. And so it gives us hope that the picture of God described here, it doesn't answer every question, but what it does offer is hope. And so today, this first two chapters of the book of Job, I invite you to read them, by the way, read the entirety of them. I want you to consider an important question here, though. to the question that was posed between the adversary and God, why do you love God? More specifically, would you love God even if bad things happen? Will you still choose to do good regardless? And so if you're presently in a season of struggle, I want you to realize that God is not giving you these things, though, because of something bad you did. That we live in a broken world. And that God is not that cosmic principle ready to punish you on every single thing that you do wrong. See, my prayer for you is that you would open yourself to the possibility of a God who loves you and is working for your good. Or maybe for you, maybe life is pretty good right now. And now I think is the time above all times to prepare, because at some point that view will be tested. There will be things that happen. To dive in deep, to discover for yourself, why do I love God? Is it only because of the blessings, or is it deeper than that? Do I only love God when things are going well, and would I hang on if not? Is our faith only rooted in the shallowness of circumstances, or is it something deeper? So why do you love God? That's the question for today. We will all encounter the test of Job and the question of Job. And my prayer for all of us is to have the response of Job as well. Let's pray.